Thank you for listening to the Redeemer Church podcast. For more information about our church, please visit www.redeemermidland.org.
And thanks, David. Y'all grab a seat and grab your Bible. Let me invite you to turn to Mark chapter 8, verse 31. If you don't have a Bible, it will be on the screen here in front of you. A few years ago, when our family was living in DFW, Hannah and I got a random phone call one day from an unknown number, which I rarely pick those up, but this day I did, and it was a company that was selling timeshares, and they wanted us to come out to go through this spiel for a timeshare, and then they were giving away free prizes. Even if we chose not to do the timeshare, we could win like a free all-exclusive trip to a resort or a cruise, and normally my dad told me, like, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So I thought, well, this is probably a waste of time. But there was a little thing at the bottom, free cookies and free coffee. So I like cookies, I like coffee. We decided to go. And so we went to this spiel, and it's kind of one of those things. I don't know if you've been to one of these, but they bring in somebody and they give you the whole thing and you say no, and they said, okay, let me go get my supervisor. They'll come back and really cut you a deal. And then, like, when you're 14 supervisors deep into this thing and you just keep saying no, like, you're getting exhausted. They're putting all the pressure on. They just kind of keep trying to make the deal sweet. And we get all the way through. And I felt like we had, like, won because we got to the very end and I was like, no, thanks, but we're not interested. And then we're walking out and you get to spin the wheel. There was like I felt like we were in Wheel of Fortune. There was this big wheel with all these different prize giveaways on it. And I had, you know, we're grabbing extra cookies and putting them in Hannah's purse and getting coffee on our way out. And then we get to spin the wheel, take the wheel, spin it. Boom, whoa, we won a free cruise. And I was so excited. They gave us the paperwork. We went home and I actually got online that night to book our free cruise because they said free. So I was excited. They kind of sold it. This is a free cruise. And there was a whole lot of fine print. How many of y'all have ever bought something with a lot of fine print? You begin to read that, and very quickly your excitement comes down. And so I began trying to book this thing, and there was like we had to pay taxes on it. We had to pay a booking fee. We had to pay a room cleaning fee. We had to like pay all these fees, and I start adding up the numbers. I'm like, I think it would have been cheaper just to get on Priceline and book a trip because of all these dumb hidden fees. Like, the fine print is killing us, and stuff like that really frustrates me. Because I feel like they're, you know, hiding the true cost so that they can just kind of get you in, and then they'll kind of get you with the cost on the back end, right? And a lot of times I think like people in churches and sometimes pastors and speakers in our culture, they can try to present the gospel in such a way that removes the real cost of following Jesus. And it kind of like puts some things in some fine print just to maybe get people in the church or grow things, or maybe even with a good intention of trying to invite people to follow Jesus. But they will take the reality that it's difficult and there's a cost involved to following Jesus, and they'll try and hide that from you. And maybe that's your story. Maybe you've kind of walked through life and heard bits and pieces of the gospel here and there and been sold this kind of false gospel where there is no cost to it at all. You were just like us, like, say, hey, it's free. You can just keep going on the same trajectory you're going. You don't have to change anything. You don't have to deny yourself anything. You don't have to forego any comfort. You definitely don't have to endure any suffering. You can just say this prayer and get Jesus, and he'll kind of jump on board with you and go where you're going. And there's not going to be any suffering. You're not going to lose any friends. There's not going to be any tension. Like, there's going to be no cost. And if you were sold that idea and you jump in and start following Jesus, it does not take long for reality to hit, right? Like, it just doesn't take long for something to happen. And if that's kind of what you were sold, like the fine print was hidden, and then it's tough following Jesus and it starts to cost you things, then sometimes you begin to be a little bit disillusioned. And you begin to ask some questions, like, is God really powerful enough? Did he lie to me? And it kind of puts you in this crisis of faith. And I just want you to know, especially with this text that we're looking at today, Jesus is not that way. He just has a very pesky habit of being unbelievably truthful and clear, and he doesn't beat around the bush. He begins to lay down the cost in this text that we're looking at today. And in no uncertain terms, he says, this is where I'm going, and this is what it's going to cost you to follow me, and I would love for you to come, but you need to know up front what it's going to cost. Because the first half of the book of Mark, if you were here last week, You found out like the pinnacle of all this energy and this life that Jesus has been living. The first half is to prove who he is as a man. And he has kind of proven through what he can do and through who he's what he teaches and all these Old Testament prophecies that he fulfills. He culminates the first half of the book. And at the end, he says, finally, guys, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ. I'm so proud of you. We did it. Like I'm telling you, every time, if you just answer Jesus, and now if you answer Christ, you'll be correct. Like the first half of the book, Jesus is proving to his followers who he is, and they finally culminate to believe you are the Christ. And the second half of the book, Jesus unpacks for them what his mission is. So first half is the man, second half of the book is the mission, and this story that Jesus tells them, these truths that he unpacks for them, it's him beginning to unpack in a very different way than what they were expecting about what his mission is. So they understood a little bit about the Messiah and the Christ from the Old Testament. And so when Jesus leads them up to that monumental moment, who do you say that I am? They say, you're the Christ. And at that moment, they're like ready to grab swords. There's thousands of people that are following Jesus. This is our moment. Like, rally the troops, start the revolt. Let's march into Jerusalem. Let's overthrow the Romans, kick them out of our city, get Jesus on the throne. He's our guy. He's the Christ. Like, they're ready, right? They're like grunting and, you know, chest bumping and getting energy. Like, this is it. He's the Christ. We're going to take over. We're going to kick out the Romans. And he's like, okay, I'm the Christ. It's going to look much different than you thought. And that's where we pick up. He begins to unpack where he's going and what his ministry is going to look like. And it's almost like that line or that scene in the Alamo. How many of y'all have seen any of the multiple Alamo movies? Like, it's the most epic moment in Texas history, right? The greatest nation on earth. He draws the line in the sand. He's like, it's going to get rough from here. If you're in and you want to stay, then you get to cross over. And that's like, this is the crossover moment in the life and ministry of Jesus. The first half of his ministry has been very much a come and see ministry. I want you to come and see what I can do. Come and see who I am. Come and see what I'm capable of, my power, my compassion. It was open to the masses, and everybody was excited about Jesus. He can do miracles. He raises people from the dead. He heals the blind. He makes the lame walk. He's unbelievable. And so the masses gather, and then this text is the shift from the come and see invitation to the go and die invitation. And every human being, I think, that even entertains the idea of following Jesus, you're going to have both of these invitations. Like, there's a season sometimes where you walk in, you're like, I'm not really sure about Jesus or the gospel. I want to read and understand a little bit, and there's kind of this come and see invitation to taste and see the Lord is good, to see what Jesus is made of. But there comes a moment where Jesus draws the line in the sand, and he says, like, you have enough information. You know who I am. I am the Christ. But now you can't come any further unless you're willing to go where I'm going. And this is a wildly unpopular topic and idea in our culture. It was a wildly unpopular thing for them. It caught them so off guard, Peter's going to really get himself into some trouble. But Jesus begins unpacking his mission, and he does it with just some unbelievable sharp truth. And I don't think he read the church growth manuals. Right, like, if he read the stuff today about what you need to do and not do in order to grow a church, he just didn't do well at that. He just had this pesky habit of telling people the truth. Like, he's like, well, you can't offend anybody. You can't say anything offensive. And Jesus, he did not do well, right? He offended people enough that they murdered him. And you're like not supposed to ask people to sacrifice anything and to do anything. He didn't do a great job at that. You're not supposed to tell some of your followers that they're Satan, and he's going to do that here in a moment. You're not supposed to talk about money, and yet Jesus hammers money and the way that we use our money all the time. He just kind of goes against the flow of the culture because he loves us and he is a truth teller, and he begins to unpack where he is going. So he doesn't have any fine print. He lays it all out there, and he's going to tell you, you know, 2,000 years removed from his life and death, how he defines being a Jesus follower or a Christian or a disciple. And the reason this is important, because oftentimes we can kind of culturally come up with our own definition of what it means to follow Jesus. I run into this all the time talking to people. I ask, are you a Christian? They say, yeah. And they'll kind of give me a definition. I say, well, that's nice, but that's not the way Jesus defines being a Christian. And if our definition and Jesus' definition differ, who wins? And everybody said, Jesus. You need to know what Jesus defines as his follower or a disciple. Because he says at the end of the days when he comes back, there's going to be a lot of people, probably quite a few in Midland, Texas, that show up and like, Lord, didn't we do all these things? Well, I was on your team, but like the way I defined it, I was a Christian. Jesus is like, yeah, but not the way I defined it. And so this is monumentally important for us to understand when we jump in. So he's shifting from come and see to go and die. If you're in Mark chapter 8, verse 31, say ready. This is what he says. And he, Jesus, began to teach them. So he had just unveiled himself as the Christ. They believed it, but he's taken a hard left turn from where they thought they were going. They were ready to grab swords and run into Jerusalem. Jesus is telling them something very different. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer. And at that moment, all the disciples are scratching their heads like, that's not the word that we thought was going to come out of your mouth next. What in the world do you mean you're going to suffer? I thought we were going to demolish the Romans and take this thing back. And Jesus says, I'm going to suffer many things. I'm going to be rejected, not embraced as the king and put on the throne, but rejected by the leaders of the day, by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed. Every category they had about the Messiah and what they were getting ramped up to do has just been shattered. Jesus says he's going to be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly, Mark tells us. Jesus, he's not talking in parables. He's not using metaphors. He's just really clearly like, guys, I'm the Christ. Here's how it's going to play out. I am going to suffer. I'm going to be rejected. I'm going to die. After 3 days, I am going to rise. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Can we all agree that's not a good idea? Like to take Jesus aside and be like, oh gosh, Jesus, if you could just catch up to speed with me and my theology. Like Peter took him aside because he was so thrown off at the direction Jesus' life and ministry was about to take. Peter was not on board and he's normally the spokesperson for the 12. So they might have had a little powwow and all of them agreed, hey, we don't like this whole suffering thing. I think Jesus got it wrong. Peter, go tell him. Peter rebukes Jesus, which is not a good idea. Took him aside, began to rebuke him, but turning and seeing his disciples. So Jesus turns, and I love how precise Mark is in situations like this. It says that there was something that Jesus saw as he looked at the disciples, the other 11, that prompted him to be unbelievably clear. Because I'm sure he saw the other disciples kind of wavering back and forth. Are they going to follow Jesus? Do they believe what Peter's saying? And it says that Jesus turned and saw his disciples, maybe read some confusion or some fear. And it says that he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Can we agree? If Jesus calls you Satan, you've gone wrong somewhere. Like Peter's agenda, Jesus says, was so far off from the gospel and the plan that God had lined out for Jesus that it was actually satanic. If Jesus would have gone the way Peter wanted to, the complete absence of suffering and just comfort and go take the throne, then a lot of people for the history of mankind would die in their sins. So Peter was very well-intentioned, but very confused. And so Jesus takes him and rebukes him. And then in verse 34, he basically draws the line in the sand and says, Jesus calling the crowd to him with his disciples. So imagine you're there. You were just kind of loving the come and see Jesus, the miracles and all the things he was doing. And you were in the crowd for years and you'd witnessed a lot of things. And Jesus invites you to come and you're about to get to see the go and die Jesus. And we really try and balance both of these invitations just at Redeemer and the way that we preach in different topics, because there's seasons that are healthy and helpful for all people. Like some people are in a season where you need to come and see who Jesus is and what he is about. But there comes a moment when Jesus invites the crowds and he says, this is where I'm going. You know enough and you can't come any further unless you're willing to pay the price. And again, no fine print. So he calls the crowds to himself with his disciples, and he said to them, if anyone would come after me, that's saying, hey, if any of you want to keep going, you followed me now in this last season, if you want to keep being my follower or being my disciple, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Three things Jesus says. This is how Jesus defines his followers. And there is no doubt some people that were there that day, that were in the masses, that were in the crowds, that came and they heard Jesus say that, and they're like, oh, you know what? I'm just not willing to deny myself. Definitely not willing to take up a cross, so I guess I'm not willing to follow you. And Jesus let them walk away, because what he's doing is laying down the cost, and in laying down the cost, he's laying down what Jesus is worth. And so that's what frustrates me the most. Like, if somebody removes the cost of discipleship, what they're doing is saying Jesus really isn't that worthy. He's not worth inconvenience. He's not worth suffering. He's not worth any kind of difficulty that we can walk through. Hannah and I have three kids. One of them is a girl. Our middle child is a girl, and I'm really debating bringing back this whole dowry thing. So some guy comes knocking on the door, I don't know, 30, 40 years from now, and he's interested in dating our daughter. I'm going to tell him, hey, that's fine. 400 goats, 30 horses, 5, big boxes of gold and silver. Because I want to test this guy. Like, do you know how valuable she is? Because if you don't understand her value, you don't get to come within 10 miles of her. I might just say that to every dude that comes knocking anyway. There's the reason behind that whole thing is, like, some dude has to prove that he understands the value before he gets married. Like, there's that Jesus is saying, like, you can come after me, you can be my follower, but it's going to cost you something. And if you're not willing to pay the price, then you don't truly understand what Jesus is worth. And I've said this over and over, and I'll say it as long as I have breath in my lungs. Like, that's the gospel story wrapped up. It's that Jesus has provided a place in heaven for eternity and glory with no suffering for those people that have captured a glimpse of the worth of Jesus. See, sometimes we present the gospel as like, is anybody in here scared of hell? You want to burn forever? No? Okay, well, raise your hand and Jesus will have you. It's like, no, hell is not a place reserved for people that are, or heaven's not a place reserved for people that are scared of hell and don't want to burn forever. It's a place reserved for people who have counted the cost and they said, yes, Jesus is worth it. So he draws a line in the sand, calling the crowd. He says, if anyone would come after me, these three things, deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. That's Jesus' definition. First thing he says, I'm heading this way, you can come, but you have to be willing to deny yourself. That's very countercultural, right? Like, there's just not a lot of things in our culture that teach us to deny ourselves. Everything else is about kind of self-actualization, and feeding all our desires and everything that we have innately wired in us. And yet Jesus says, if we're going to follow Jesus, there has to be this moment that we're willing to set aside our agenda to deny our, like, the trajectory of our life so that we can follow the trajectory of Jesus' plans. We have to set aside our own desire for glory and for preeminence, for his glory and preeminence. We have to set aside our desire for comfort to be willing to be discomforted for Jesus. Like, that's the invitation for you. Like, Jesus, it wants you to be a follower, but the first thing we have to be willing to do is to deny ourselves, to take ourselves off the throne of our hearts, put Jesus on the throne. That's to deny ourselves. The second thing, he says that we have to be willing to take up a cross. I think what he's saying is that Jesus' followers must be willing to suffer. Some people and some religions even take this way out in left field, and they think that they're actually to cause suffering to themselves, and if they're, the more that we suffer, the more holy that we are, so they will beat themselves and deprive themselves of things, not because they have to, but because they think that makes them more holy, right? And it's not the presence of suffering that makes us holy, it's the willingness to endure suffering for Jesus. So he asks us to take up our cross, and I think that term has lost some of its edge because we have a lot of nice pretty crosses in our houses, right? We have things that are pretty hanging up. And if you were to say that to these people that were on the hill that day to take up their cross, there would have been somewhat of a cringe. you know, maybe a really horrible feeling in their gut because they had seen people crucified, and that's what Jesus was asking them to be willing to do. And one of the most unbelievable things to me is that the men who heard him that day, those disciples, they knew more than we ever will the cost of what it truly means to carry a cross, and yet there was something about Jesus that caused them to think it was worth it. Like, they chose very clearly that Jesus laid out the cost before them, but the worth of Jesus was more than the cost of carrying their cross. But we have to be willing to suffer. That means there's going to be moments when, for you to identify with Jesus, it's going to cost you some friendships, might cost you some commission, might cost you some type of suffering or some type of comfort. Yet in Jesus' estimation, he says, if you're going to come, that's what you have to be willing to do. Deny yourself, to take up your cross, and to follow Jesus. The third one, and it feels funny saying this because it's so redundant, but Jesus' followers have to follow Jesus. Like, Jesus' followers have to be willing to go where Jesus went, to do what Jesus did, to avoid what Jesus avoided, to spend time with people that Jesus spent time with. Like, the trajectory of our lives has to be, like, behind Jesus. Sometimes there's these false gospels. Hey, Jesus, you can follow Jesus, the one that suffered and rejected and died. You can follow Jesus and all your problems will go away. It's like, that's not the life of, have you read the book? Like, if you open the book and start reading about Jesus, like, that's our story. That's our biography. If we're willing to follow Jesus, it's going to include some suffering and some difficulty along the way. Let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me, verse 35. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Jesus is going to give us two options, and this is the option for every human being. You get one life to invest. You have two places that you can take your life. Jesus says you can invest in the kingdom and find it, or you can try and find identity in something else, and you're going to end up losing it. Whoever would save his life will lose it. And what he's saying is, whatever, you know, we try to save our life, we try to find identity or meaning or fulfillment in something other than Jesus, and in doing so, what we end up doing is chasing something so hard and putting so much energy into it, it actually begins to ruin our lives and our souls. All right, that's option one. Option two is, whoever loses his life for Jesus' sake and the gospel's sake will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. So I want to tease these both of these options out for just a moment. So the first question is, how do you lose your soul? If that's an option, which I hope we would all say, I don't want to do that. Like, that's not the plan, to lose my soul. How do we get there? And I think Jesus is unpacking that the way you lose your soul is you focus your life on secondary things. You don't focus your life on, like, evil things. Like, you know, sometimes we think, oh, I'll avoid losing my soul because I'm not going to worship Satan tomorrow, right? That's not how we get on that road. We get on that road by taking really good things and treating them as ultimate things and trying to find meaning and just purpose, total purpose and identity in our jobs. Some of you, like, it's in the amount of money. You think, oh, if I can just get a little bit more money in my savings account, or my salary can get bumped up a little bit, I'll have a little bit more meaning, a little bit more fulfillment, a little bit more joy. Maybe it's a relationship. Maybe you think, if I could just get a spouse, if I could find a husband or a wife, that would be like trying to save your life, trying to find all these answers to this desire in our souls. And Jesus says there's a way to do that till the end, till you look back and you're like, I got all these things, but it didn't do for my heart what I hoped it would. And listen to me, because this is unbelievably important for Midland, Texas to hear. Because there is a strong tendency to think like there's a fulfillment just one step ahead. Like, if I could just get this one step, this one promotion, just invest 10 more hours a week into my job, trying to just save your life, there's a very strong possibility you get to the end and you find out what Solomon found out. You're like, oh my gosh, it's all vanity. It didn't work. Because we have the idea that, like, if we're unfulfilled, that it's in the amount, right? We just don't have enough. And Solomon, the guy in the Old Testament, he ran that to that course to the end. Like, he had so much money and so many servants and so much fine stuff. There was not any more he could have. And he looked back and he's like, that didn't work. It didn't fulfill my soul. It's easy in Midland, Texas, to try to save your soul and to lose it by chasing bad things, by making your job the ultimate, by making your spouse the ultimate, by taking any good secondary thing and making it primary. How many of you remember the book Of Mice and Men? I had to read it a long time ago in school, and I thought about it this week. I think it paints a really good picture that there's this man in the story named Lenny, and Lenny has this little mouse that he loves, and he loves it so much he like squeezes it to death. And his love for this, and you know, later on the story gets him into trouble, and ends up he loves things to death, and it ends up being his demise. Like, that's kind of how this plays out with us. If you love something and expect it to satisfy the longings of your soul, that tends to be the thing that undoes you. This is what C.S. Lewis says in an essay that he wrote titled First and Second Things. He's giving examples of this, how we can give our lives to secondary things and it ends up kind of ruining stuff. He says, the woman who makes a dog the center of her life loses in the end not only her human usefulness and dignity, but even the proper pleasure of dog keeping. Sorry if you're a dog lover. You can be a dog lover secondary, but he's saying, like, let's just take this case scenario. This woman, like, the dog is everything to her. It's going to end up ruining not only her as a human being, but she can't even enjoy the dog like she rightly should because she's put so much weight on this dog. The next illustration he gives, he says, the man who makes alcohol his chief good loses not only his job, but his palate and his ability to enjoy alcohol. Like, if you take something, you elevate it, it just kind of destroys things. He says, take a guy, for instance, take a dude. I don't think C.S. Lewis used the word dude, but I did. You take this guy, and he takes this woman, he elevates her on this pedestal of, like, this is the center of the universe and all his hopes and dreams, and if he can just get her, all of his problems will be answered. He says, if you make a woman the whole center of the universe and she has all the meaning in the world, that's too much weight for her to bear. You will be disappointed, and you will crush her. And he says in the end, he says, if you take any secondary thing that is normally a good thing and you treat it as a primary thing or as a God thing, you will lose it all. You cannot get second things by putting them first. You get second things only by putting first things first. He says, you can't get meaning in your job by chasing your job. But if you chase Jesus, you can get a blessing from your job. Are y'all with me? Like, the priority is what Jesus is after. If you take what only Jesus can give a human being, satisfaction in your soul, meaning and identity, and you remove it and you put anything good in there, you're going to ruin that thing and you're going to end up at the end of your life turning around saying, God, that just didn't do what I thought it would do. How many of y'all have ever gotten a raise? And how many of you, after that raise, you said, praise God, we made it. I don't need any more ever again. We don't, because you like we all have right now what we wanted at some point in our life in the past. But when we get there, it's like there's always a little bit more. And you could chase that carrot till you're 80 years old and look back and say, dadgummit, I should have learned my lesson 30 years ago. Reminds me of a story. I've been just unbelievably encouraged these last few weeks. We have launched Redeemer South Campus, and I was really surprised. John Mark and I were both surprised at the people that were willing to give their lives for this. It was mostly empty nesters here at Redeemer, and just got to sit down and hear some of their stories, and just really, truly, I have been challenged and encouraged by their willingness to invest in gospel work in people's lives in South Midland. And one of the things that keeps coming up that I've heard from some of these empty nester couples is that they have kind of lived the dream in Midland. You know, they've got the raises, they've got the houses, they've traveled every weekend, they got the beach house, they got the lake house, they did all that, and they're realizing that it just didn't quite do for their soul what they thought it would. And so they're turning around and reinvesting it. And a couple of them have told me they wish they could come back and tell those people that were 30 years behind them what Jesus is saying. It is very possible to try and save your life by chasing after these good things. And in the end, that's what ends up robbing your soul. Like you finally get all the money you want and you have ruined your marriage. You finally got all the hours you devoted in, you got the promotion, and your kids are estranged from you. Like you've finally got all the possessions that you wanted and you've got to the end and it just hasn't done what you thought it would do, because Ecclesiastes says it's like a chasing after the wind. Like you can't grab it because it's not there. It has nothing to do with the amount. It has to do with the substance. So please listen to Jesus. He's not saying this because he like despises us. He's saying this to us because he loves you and he wants your joy. So he says, listen, I don't want you to waste your life trying to find identity and trying to save your life with these secondary things. So how you lose your soul, you focus your life on secondary things. So how do you save your soul? Jesus says you do so by giving it up. It's this weird dynamic that the gospel plays out, that the more we try and find it in other ways, the more we lose it, but the more we're willing to invest it and give our lives over to Jesus and the sake of the gospel, the more we find what we were meant to be. Amen? I've talked to a lot of Christians really all over the planet that have given some incredible sacrifices for the sake of the gospel. Talked to, you know, some brothers of ours, some Christian brothers in India that, you know, took their shirt off and just show the lashes that the Hindu government has put on their back. And some have lost families. They've had businesses burnt to the ground because they followed Jesus. Like some incredible cause. Even people in this room that have had family members turn on them because they followed Jesus. I've talked to a lot of Christians that have paid a very high price. And there may be one out there, but I truly have never met a Christian that has paid a high price that regretted it. Because this is like you put any type of cost in this side of the scale, and if you put Jesus in the other one, he outweighs it all. That's the point. It's like if you lose your life for the sake of Jesus and the gospel, you'll find what it's truly about. And then everything else, all the money and the jobs, they become blessings because they're not bearing the weight of giving you an identity. And this, there's an interesting article that I'll mention, and then I'll close here in a moment. But this was so pointed, I thought, to just the culture and the flow of values that we find ourselves in Midland. Maybe you read this. It came out a couple weeks ago. It was in the Atlantic. It was written by an author named Derek Thompson. I think from his writing, I don't think that he's a Christian, but he had some incredibly profound insights into what he's seeing. Back in 1930, there was an economist, John Maynard Keynes, that predicted, because he saw these trends, that we were getting much more efficient with the way that we were able to work, that by the early 21st century, where we're at now, we would be working a 15-hour work week because we just simply wouldn't have to work that much. Because forever, work had been something to produce an economic value. And so his theory was, you know, by our time, we won't be working that much because we won't have to in order to survive. And so this author says that the exact opposite thing has happened, especially, and this is why I bring it up today. He says, especially this is the case to well-educated, rich people in the United States, that we are not working less for the first time in history. The more money you have, the more you're working, not because you have to, but because we're finding our identity in work. And he, non-Christian, is saying it's not working. Like we're trying as hard as we can to work more, work more, work more, have more, have more, have more. And it's like he could read Mark 8. Like that's what he's saying. It's like don't try to save your life and lose your soul. And so I say that because there's this temptation, this cultural flow that's going to sell us this lie that these other things are more important than Jesus. And yet Jesus says, if you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, all these other things that you desire will be added to you. Jesus first, that's how you save your life. You invest your life for the sake of Jesus and the gospel. Let me invite you to bow your head and to pray with me that this would encourage us and that we truly would hear Jesus like begging and pleading with us not to run away from good things, but to actually find what life is about. And he's trying to steer us towards abundant life. Jesus, we're all grateful that you are willing to suffer. You're willing to be betrayed by people that should have worshipped you. You were willing to die in our place, and you had the power to rise from the grave. And you gave us an invitation, not only for the glory that's going to be for eternity, but for a mild season of suffering between now and then. God, I pray that you would give us the faith to endure suffering. God, we're not called to enjoy it by any means, but to endure it for your sake. God, help us to understand in our culture what it looks like to suffer well for you. God, I pray that we might truly, each one of us, hear the invitation to deny ourselves, to take up our cross and follow you, and in doing so, that we might truly uncover what life is about. God, that you've created us for yourself, and all these other things are blessings that fall in line when we worship you. God, I thank you for your sacrifice for us and your suffering for us. Pray, as Hebrews says, that we would fix our eyes on you as we labor to be Christians in this day and age, that we would focus on how you lived and what you did, to fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, and for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. We consider you because you endured such opposition and from sinful men, so that we won't grow weary and lose heart. Father, I pray if there's someone that's growing weary and lose heart, they would remember that Jesus suffered and that you were glorified, and we will be glorified as well if we suffer well. So God, I pray that you'd help us to be true Christians that follow you. I pray all this in Jesus' name.